Your program feature will begin in just a moment. First, a reminder, we have a Bible Institute here at BBN. At bbnradio.org, just click Bible Institute.
Hey, how's that home building project going? Let BBN help you as you build a strong family to the glory of God. Welcome to Building Blocks for the Family. Our guest is Gary Chapman. Parenthood has its frustrations, its challenges, but also its rewards. In the midst of all that, what should be our basic objectives in raising our children? Here's Gary Chapman. Three goals for parents.
There are two great pitfalls for parents in teaching respect for parental authority. I want you to hear me carefully. In my opinion, these are the two greatest pitfalls we face, and many parents have fell into one of these. The first pitfall is discipline without love. Discipline without love. Some of us as Christians are strong on discipline, but we're weak on love. We tell them what they're to do, and we press them to make sure they do it, but we're weak on love. And we will never teach parental respect when we are strong on discipline and we're weak on love. You see what happens when that takes place? Love focuses on the needs of the child, and that's where the parents should be focused, on the needs of the child. Discipline without love focuses on the need of the parent. Some of us, because of our own emotional insecurities, feel that we must be in control and we must have the last word, and we come across as a despot to our children, and they have the feeling they don't love me. All they do is, well, make me do what they want for their benefit. Make them look good. And that's the attitude. That's what they feel inside. We're making them, trying to make ourselves look good. And that kind of discipline will never, ever teach child respect for authority. The other pitfall is the opposite end of the continuum. It is leniency without love. Leniency without love. You see, again, love focuses on the need of the child. But when we are lenient with our children without love, it focuses on the need of the parent. And so we have a significant number of parents in our society who have the feeling and the attitude to the children, do what you wish, don't bother me. You see, they're too insecure to face conflict with their children and to work through conflict with their children. It's easier to let the children do what they want to do. And so they're very lenient. They let the children do what they wish to do. That is not love. Now, I read recently of a son who said to his father, I hate you. The father, shocked by that statement, inquired of the son, why do you say that? And here was his answer. Because you never denied me anything that I wanted. Isn't that strange? You never denied me anything that I wanted. You know what the child is saying? That parent has fallen into the pitfall of leniency without love. I'm telling you, to give a child everything they want, whenever they want it, is not love. It is leniency without love. That is not the way to teach them respect for authority. Now, there needs to be some leniency. There must be leniency. That word leniency means mild. It means soft. It means merciful. Not rigorous, not severe. There needs to be some leniency. We need to have some softness. But always that softness is to be with love. That is, our thought is to be the child's well-being. The child's well-being, not our well-being. We don't let them do what they want to do in order so that we don't have to spend our time. We can do what we want to do by giving them that. No. We give them freedom. We're soft. We're merciful. But it's when we think it is for their benefit to be so. Now listen to me. We will tend to be more merciful to our children. We will tend to learn what leniency is all about if we will listen to our children. Listen to our children. I had a pastor's wife say to me this week, Dr. Chapman, I hate to say this, but my husband never, ever listens to our daughter. He always tells her what to do, but he never has listened to our daughter all her life. He has never listened. And she said, now they have no relationship. I said, how old is your daughter? She said, 18. And she was asking me, how do I as a mother help my husband and my daughter have a relationship? Well, I'll tell you what I told her. Here was my advice. I said, I'm not sure you can. You shouldn't take that responsibility on your shoulders. I'm not sure you can. But I can give you something you can try. You might suggest to him that perhaps it is time for him to say to his daughter, I realize that I have failed you through the years. I have not been a good father in that I have not listened to you. And consequently, I don't know you very well. And I would like to ask you to forgive me for always having the answers, but never really hearing the questions. I'd like to ask you to forgive me. And if you're willing, I would like to listen and get to know you. I said, maybe, if he would do that, maybe she would open up and forgive him and begin to talk. And maybe they could have a relationship. But I said, I'm not sure you can pull that off. You can share the idea. I'm not sure your husband will respond. You see, it's very difficult to break those patterns of being domineering without listening to our children. Discipline, but no leniency. And the child doesn't feel loved, but they feel like they've been run over every time. They will never respect our authority until they can see that we are people who are concerned about fairness, about justice, about mercy. And how can you be fair as a parent if you don't listen to both sides? However can we be fair if we don't listen to the child's side? And listen to me, the older they get, the more we must listen. Now, when they're 2 and 3 and 4, it's all right. It's all right. You've got to make the decisions. In fact, you've got to do almost all of it because they'll put their hands in the fire if you don't. I mean, you've got to do almost everything. But the older they get, the more you must learn to listen because they are thinking now. They are feeling now inside. And if you're going to minister to them discipline and leniency and love, you're going to have to know where they're coming from and what's going on inside of them. And so you will have to learn to listen so you can be fair. Look at God. That's what He does. God disciplines us to be sure. Read Hebrews chapter 12 if you doubt that. But God always disciplines us in love. He listens to us. He listens to our pain. He lets us pour out our anger to Him. Read the Bible and you'll find His children railing at Him because they feel like He's treated them wrongly. And God listens to them and God hears them out and then God responds to them in a loving way. We have to learn to listen to our children if we're going to teach them respect for parental authority. And then they come to respect civil authority. I thought the illustration Pastor gave this morning from our city was a wonderful illustration of the mother who moved in and broke up that riot before it got started. I don't know if you saw this week. I was up at Fruitland Baptist Bible Institute speaking 2 days this week, and one afternoon I saw Oprah. do y'all watch Oprah Winfrey? Well, I don't either, usually. But I saw her as I was going out for dinner. And they were screaming at each other about the L.A. situation. And there was one lady. You know, Oprah's usually pretty good on controlling that microphone. And she can move around pretty fast. But this lady grabbed her hand. And while she was speaking, she held on to Oprah's hand. And she started telling her story about what had happened. And every time she would make a point, they would all start cheering. And she would say, hold on, hold on, hold on. And she would tell another part of the story. And they would cheer. And she said, hold on, hold on, hold on. And she went through that about 5 times. And she held Oprah's hand, telling the other people to hold on. She wasn't through yet. At the very end, she said one last time, hold on, hold on, hold on. And then she said, I want you to hear me. She said, we have been screaming, where are the policemen? Where are the policemen? And we have been screaming, where are the teachers? Where are the teachers? And she said, what I want to say is, where were we? Where were the parents? Wow. She's asking the right question. Because you see, children will never learn respect for civil authority until they first learn respect for parental authority. Whoo! Second goal. We must teach them to accept responsibility for their own actions. to accept responsibility for their own actions. Verse 11, verse 1. Interesting that Paul said this in the midst of his little brief defense. He said, "If, however, I am guilty of doing anything deserving death, I do not refuse to die." Do you hear what he just said? If I have done anything deserving of death, I do not refuse to die. Here is a man, you can study his life before this and after this, here is a man who accepted responsibility for his own actions. He's willing to accept responsibility for his own actions. If I've broken the law, I'm willing to take my rap. That was Paul's attitude. Now this means that we must teach our children how to make decisions, realizing that every decision they make will have results. Every decision they make will have results. You see, Paul made his decision in verses 9, 10, and 11. He made his decision to appeal to Caesar. He reasoned in his mind. You can see it happening if you read behind the scenes. Festus has said in verse 9, "Are you willing to go to Jerusalem?" Now, when Festus says that, Paul reasons in his mind, "I think I'll never get a fair trial under this man. Any man that will waver like that, knowing I should not go to Jerusalem, but trying to talk me into going to Jerusalem, I'll never get a fair trial under this man." And Paul already knew what would happen if he went to Jerusalem. He had the word there. They were out to kill him. He knew what would happen in Jerusalem. And Paul reasoned in his mind, "I cannot be tried under Festus. I certainly am not going back to Jerusalem. I appeal to Caesar." And he made his decision. He saw Festus wavering. He perceived what needed to be done. He made his decision, and he never looked back. And Paul is now on his road to Rome. Someone once asked J.C. Penney how he had managed to go so far in the business world. And J.C. Penney said this, "One, I pray seriously for wisdom. I pray seriously for wisdom. Secondly, I think as clearly as I can. Thirdly, I make my decision. And fourth, I never look back. I live with the results of my decision." Now here's a man who had learned how to make decisions and was responsible for his decisions, took the responsibility for them. Now, how do you teach children to make good decisions? By letting them make decisions. There is no other way. You cannot pour it into them. You have to let them make decisions in order to learn how to make good decisions. You have to make a few poor decisions and see that I did this, and look, it didn't turn out very well. That's the way children learn to make decisions, by making decisions. May I suggest you start that very, very young? Give your children some options, but let them make decisions within parameters very, very, very young. Let them decide to put up their toys before dinner or after dinner. That's a choice. Let them decide to bring their bicycle in before dinner or at you. But you give them parameters, but very, very young, they can learn to make decisions. And as they get older, you let them make more and more decisions. And in the making of those decisions, they learn that whatever I do, whatever decision I make, there's going to be results. So I want to be careful how I make this decision and make sure that I make a wise decision. Now you see, as adults, there are a few things more important than that in operating in society. Learning to accept responsibility for your actions. But have you not seen it where you work? I mean, the workplace is full of people who are blamers. They pass blame to somebody else. Whatever happens, whatever comes out of their work, You see, they've never learned to say, "You know, you're right. I goofed. I'm sorry. I goofed." They've never learned to accept responsibility. They pass the blame onto somebody else. We have to let our children learn to make decisions so that they can come to accept responsibility. This is what God does. God doesn't tell you every little thing about life and make you do everything right. God doesn't do that. God gives us the important truths to live by. And then he lets us make decisions within those parameters. For example, just to illustrate, he says, for example, your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. Now you take care of it. But he doesn't tell you what to eat for breakfast. He doesn't tell you lay off the sausage. He doesn't tell you stick with the oat bran. He doesn't tell you. He gives you the basic principle. Your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit. Now you take care of it. Now I'm going to tell you, if you eat sausage every day, get ready to die early, because you will. It's just that simple. We are responsible for making decisions, but he gives us latitude within the framework. He gives us the principles, then he lets us make decisions, and we learn as we go along. Some of us learn very slowly, but we learn as we go along. You use your mind, you make decisions, and whatever you decide, there will be results that will come from that. We teach our children to come to accept responsibility for their actions by letting them make decisions in the home. And number three, the third goal, we want to teach them courage to live by their beliefs. Courage to live by their beliefs. Will you listen to the next section in this chapter, verse 13? A few days later, King Agrippa and Bernice arrived at Caesarea to pay their respects to Festus. Since they were spending many days there, Festus discussed Paul's case with the king. He said, "There's a man here whom Felix left as a prisoner. When I went to Jerusalem, the chief priest and the elders of the Jews brought charges against him and asked that he be condemned. I told them that it is not the Roman custom to hand over any man before he has faced his accusers and has had an opportunity to defend himself against the charges. When they came here with me, I did not delay the case, but I convened the court the next day and ordered the man to be brought in. When his accusers got up to speak, they did not charge him with any of the crimes I had expected. Instead, they had some points of dispute with him about their own religion and about a dead man named Jesus, whom Paul claimed was alive. I was at a loss how to investigate such matters. So I asked if he would be willing to go to Jerusalem and stand trial there on these charges. When Paul made his appeal to be held over for the emperor's decision, I ordered him held until I could send him to Caesar. Then Agrippa said to Festus, I would like to hear this man myself. He replied, tomorrow you will hear him. The next day, Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp and entered the audience room with the high-ranking officers and the leading men of the city. At the command of Festus, Paul was brought in. Festus said, King Agrippa, and all who are present with us, you see this man? A whole Jewish community has petitioned me about him in Jerusalem and here in Caesarea, shouting that he ought not to live any longer. I found he had done nothing deserving of death, but because he made his appeal to the emperor, I decided to send him to Rome. But I have nothing definite to write to his majesty about him. Therefore, I have brought him before all of you, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that as a result of this investigation, I may have something to write. For I think it is unreasonable to send on a prisoner without specifying the charges against him." The center of Paul's belief system is found in verse 19. Festus puts it this way, "It was a matter of a dead man named Jesus, whom Paul claimed to be alive." At the very heart of Paul's belief system was the belief that Jesus Christ was alive, and that he, Paul, had been called as an apostle to the Gentiles and as a preacher to the Jews. And all of his life was lived out based on that fundamental belief. Look at his life from the time he was converted, and all of his life was lived by that fundamental belief. In spite of the fact, verse 2, that he had long-term opposition. You see, he had been there 2 years in prison already, but when Festus went down to Jerusalem, the same group of people that were after him 2 years ago went straight to Festus and pressed the issue. Long-term opposition, 2 years, and they're still there to nail him. Incidentally, did you ever wonder what happened to the 40-plus men who 2 years before said, "We will not eat until that man Paul is dead"? They must be hungry by now, or dead themselves, I don't know. In spite of long-term opposition, Paul lived by his convictions. Even when he was falsely accused, verse 7 and 8, all their accusations were false. They had always been false. I don't know if you've ever been accused falsely or not, but it's not a very good feeling. when people are saying things about you that aren't true. In spite of that, Paul stuck by his guns. He lived by his convictions. In spite of the fact that it seemed like everyone was against him, verse 24, at least that's what Festus said. He said the whole Jewish community is against this man. It may feel like that sometimes to you, but everybody in my family's against me. But Paul lived by his convictions in spite of that fact. Verse 25 and 26, will you look at that very carefully? Festus says, I have found in this man nothing deserving of death, but because he made his appeal to the emperor, I decided to send him to Rome, but I have nothing definite to write to his majesty about. Paul lived so closely to his convictions that Festus, a non-Christian ruler, could find nothing with which to charge him. You see, Paul had said that in chapter 24 and verse 16. I mentioned it last Sunday when Paul said, I've committed myself to live with an empty conscience toward God and toward men. I've committed myself for every night to be able to look God in the face and every night to be able to look men in the face. Paul had committed himself to that. And here's an example. Even the non-Christian ruler could find nothing wrong with him. One of the great tragedies of modern society is that we have separated religious belief from daily practice. The polls show that more people believe in God in this country than ever in the history of this country, a higher percentage. And more people say they believe in the moral teachings of the Bible. That's what the polls show. Higher numbers believe in God and the moral teachings of the Bible than ever before. And yet, we have more murder, we have more rape, we have more child abuse, we have more wife abuse, we have more emotional abuse in the family, we have more corruption in business than ever in the history of this country. Why? We have separated religious belief from daily practice. And religious belief is something you do on Sunday. It's something you give verbal assent to. It's not something you live by on Monday. One of the most important goals a parent can have is to teach their children to live by their beliefs. I would rather see a non-Christian who was consistent and living by his or her beliefs, even if they were not Christian beliefs, I'd rather see that than to see someone who claims to believe Christian truth and not live by it. There's greater hope for the non-Christian. Because when that man or woman is converted, you can bet they will live for God. Paul was one of them. You see, before Paul was ever converted, this is not simply a Christian characteristic. Before he was ever converted, he was this kind of man. He had this kind of character. That's why he was killing Christians before he was converted. Because he lived by his beliefs. He believed that he was doing right when he was killing Christians because he believed they were heretics. He was a man. I don't know where he learned it, but I think he learned it at home. He didn't learn it from God. He learned it before he was a Christian. That you live by your beliefs. Now, how do we teach children? I believe the best way, the most effective way, is by your example. By your example. Now, does that mean then that we have to be perfect? Thank God. No. 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 Thank God. But it does mean that we have to admit our failures. And we have to ask forgiveness. I've told you this before. The teenager who said to me, Dr. Chapman, I've never heard my father admit that he's wrong about anything. I've never heard my father say to me, my mother, my sister, I've never heard my father say, I was wrong. I'm sorry. Will you forgive me? Never heard my father admit he's wrong. You understand what that father's teaching that child by his example? When you get to be big, son, you can do any crazy thing you want to and it'll be all right. We teach our children not by being perfect, but we teach them by acknowledging when we fail. You see, we get so caught up as adults in doing the politically correct thing, the thing that'll get me what I want in life, that we forget about truth, we forget about right and wrong, we forget about love and mercy. It's okay to fail. It's okay to fail. Call it what it is, however, when you fail, and recognize that you're not a failure because you failed. You see, the reason some of us as adults find it hard to admit that we're wrong is because our parents told us coming up we were wrong, we were wrong, we were wrong. And emotionally we decided inside, when I get to be big, I'll never be wrong. I'll always be right. And we find it hard to admit we're wrong because we think to admit that we're wrong means that we're a failure. I want to tell you, you better tell yourself, you better re-educate yourself. To fail is not to be a failure. We all are going to fail. Nobody here is going to be perfect. You're not going to live it perfectly before your children. Don't kid yourself. You're not going to live it perfectly before them. But when you do fail, we need to tell them, I was wrong. It is not right for a father to lose his temper like I did. It is not right for a mother to do what I just did. I want you to know that. I'm sorry. It was wrong. And by our example of nailing ourselves, we teach them to live by what they believe as we live by what we believe. We have to be authentic. I pray that my children will have the courage to live by their beliefs. I pray that for myself. More than anything in being a Christian, I would like to live by my beliefs. And I would like for them to live by their beliefs. This is not the whole story on parenting, these three things, but they are three important goals. I'd like to ask you as an adult, if you would put these three goals on the refrigerator door of your mind so that every day you can look at them. A respect for civil authority. Accept the responsibility for my actions. Don't blame my wife or my children or somebody else. Accept responsibility for my actions and have the courage to live by what I believe. Keep them before yourself, so that you can grow in these things. Now, some of you as adults, some of you as teenagers, didn't learn these things at home. Your parents didn't teach you. Listen to me. Don't give up. As an adult, you can learn these things. As a teenager, you can learn them on your own, and we must learn them. Put them down in your book. Look at them constantly until you begin to see what needs to be done in your life so that these three things can be true for you. Because if you want to make the greatest impact for God in the world, these three things will have to become true in your adult life. Whether you learn them as children or whether you had to learn them as adults by yourself with God's help. But we must learn these three things. Now I want to close by just asking you, what steps do you need to take to improve yourself as a parent? And please don't think about five things, just think about one. What one thing do I need to do to improve as a parent? What is it? Nail it out as specifically as you can and ask God to help you go home and do it, whatever it is. And as young people, as single adults, let's ask ourselves, as an adult, as a young person, what do I need to do tonight to grow in one of these areas? Or to maintain these things that my parents taught me when I was younger and I've let slip? What do I need to do? My hope is that every one of us here tonight, young and old, would take some step in one of these three areas in growing to be this kind of person.
Three goals for parents. That was Gary Chapman. You've been listening to Building Blocks for the Family from the Bible Broadcasting Network, helping you build a strong family to the glory of God.
That concludes the online feature. By the way, BBN is on social media. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter.